ويبقى الله أكبر الله أكبر الله
Assalamu alaikum, ladies and gentlemen. Peace be upon you all. And welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. I'm your host, Muhammad Hussein Hosni. And this is going to be our third episode in the series on prophethood, prophethood in Islam. Our guest today is Dr. Jamal Badawi. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Jamal, and welcome to our program. Maybe we should start, as usual, by a quick recap of the last episode.
Two basic areas we covered last time. One was a continuation of the discussion of the concept of revelation. The highlights of what was mentioned last time is that if we focus on the perhaps the last and most authenticated and documented form of revelation through the last prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that is revelation through the agency of angel Gabriel, that this was a dictation of the revelation directly to the Prophet, who uttered, without using his own words, the passages of the Quran. And we said that this was not a guarded secret. It's something that happened often in the presence of many of the companions of the Prophet. It didn't only happen once or twice. It happened over the span of 23 years, the mission or ministry of Prophet Muhammad. And that the Quran, which is the product of those states of revelation, is still available in our hands for examination. We also emphasize that no believer in God can deny or dismiss revelation because it's not empirical or something that's tangible that you can touch. Because after all, we said that divine revelation is the foundation of all revealed religions. Anyone who believes in God, Allah, and his capacity to communicate his will to humanity, obviously would have to believe in revelation, even though it's not something to put in a test tube. Nor can revelation be dismissed under excuses such as hallucination or epilepsy, because like we discussed last time, they are totally different things when you talk about epilepsy versus the state of revelation where you get wisdom and you get holy books that guides humanity. We also made the distinction between the various meanings of inspiration, that even though there's a very select and special meaning of divine revelation in a sense of holy books communicated to prophets and messengers of God, that the word inspiration itself is not limited to prophets. We talked about inspiring in a sense of teaching bees, for example, inspiring pious people certain truth, but still something that's limited to them and not as a general message to be conveyed to the rest of humanity. This was the first issue on revelation. Mm-hmm. And then we started looking into the nature of prophethood, who is a prophet. And we tried to document heavily from the Quran that after all, prophets and messengers of God are human beings. They are just like you and me in the various human physiological functions. They eat and drink and die and get sick. However, they are a very select type of people to be qualified to exemplify the message and provide a good model of belief and behavior for their people.
Great. Now, for the benefit of our audience, who most probably will be predominantly from the Judeo-Christian tradition, can we draw a parallel? Can we draw a comparison between the concept of prophethood in Islam and the concept of prophethood in the Judeo-Christian tradition, or the biblical concept of prophethood in other sense?
There are similarities, but there are very important differences. Some people make a very superficial conclusion. They say, the Quran talks about the same prophets like the Bible, so maybe Muhammad took it from the Bible, they say they're identical. But there are similarities, however. Like I mentioned before, the major monotheistic faith, at least so-called Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, have definitely a great deal in common. The notion of believing in God as the ultimate authority in the universe. We might differ in questions of Trinity or chosenness or whatever, but still the whole notion of believing God is there. In prophethood also, the general notion of God sending prophets or messengers to guide humanity, this is quite common in the three monotheistic faith too. The concept of revelation, as we discussed, is also accepted in some form or the other, but at least the whole notion of God inspiring messengers the truth. However, I think there are some differences which are very, very important to realize. And this we call in Islam the isma, or the infallibility of the Prophet. To clarify, and since we're making comparisons, it would be fair to also refer and document from both scriptures, the Bible and the Quran. As I mentioned, if you recall in the previous series, the second series on prophethood, that from the Muslim point of view, the problems we have with the Bible is that in the New Testament, there is one extreme of deifying a prophet to the level of godhood.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I mentioned but briefly that there is another extreme also of attributing cardinal sins to great prophets. And we said that the Muslim does not accept both.
Mm-hmm.
Since we have talked already last time about the question of deification of humans and give the evidence from the Quran contrary to that, perhaps we might as well focus today on the question of fallibility or infallibility of the prophets. Like I said, in the Old Testament we find stories that stun the Muslim, in fact. Examples of this would be the story about Prophet Jacob and his father, Prophet Isaac, may peace be upon them both. As you know, the tradition has been in the Old Testament that the elder son inherits, the honor. And it says that, that's particularly in the book of Genesis, chapter 27, that Esau was the older son of Isaac, and he was the one who was supposed to receive the blessing.
He had the birthright.
Right, has the birthright. And that somehow the information reached Jacob that God, that his father Isaac is going to bless Esau. So he went to his father, exploiting the fact that he was almost blind. He said his sight was very, very weak.
The father, yeah.
The father, Isaac. And Jacob went to him, pretending that he is Esau, until Isaac blessed Jacob instead, by mistake.
At the instigation of the mother, we may
ask. At the instigation of the mother, that's right. And then later on, Esau discovered that, and Isaac discovered that, and said there is no way because he has already blessed Jacob by mistake. Well, a kind of story like this depicts a great prophet who is adored by Muslim, Prophet Jacob, peace be upon him, as a cheater and deceiver who goes to his father and lie to him and pretend that he's the other son in order to get that blessing. A Muslim would have a different problem accepting a kind of story like this. In the book of Exodus, in chapter 32, especially verses 1 through 6, it describes how Prophet Aaron, the brother of Moses, Prophet Moses, may peace be upon them both, how he himself participated in collecting gold to put it and carve it and to make the famous golden calf.
While Moses was on the mountain accepting the Ten Commandments.
Right. Now, it depicts here a great prophet, respected and adored by Muslims, as someone who's not only acquiesced to idolatry, but even participate himself and make the making of the golden calf. A Muslim can never accept this kind of accusation. What is even very strange in the mind of the Muslim is the story about Prophet David in the second book of Samuel, where he talks about the incident when Uriah, one of the commanders of Prophet David, was away in a battlefield, and then it says that David went on top of the king's house and he looked and he found a beautiful woman bathing, so he sent to ask or inquire about her, and he was told that this is the wife of his commander, or that soldier, officer, Uriah, and then he sent for her, committed adultery with her. And then when Uriah came back, it depicts Prophet David, peace be upon him, as a person who wanted to play all kind of tricks to hide the crime that he committed, the sin that he did. So he asked it, and that's again, like I said, all in the book of Samuel, yeah. Second book of Samuel. Then he asked Uriah to go and wash his feet inside his house. He meant you go and sleep with your wife to hide the source of the new baby. And then Uriah, being very, faithful to his soldier, he refused.
He had a pledge with the soldiers that they would not touch their wives until they
were... Exactly. So he refused, and he slept outside the doorstep of his house. Mm-hmm. And when this trick did not work, then it narrates or claims that Prophet David sent a message with Uriah and sent to one of his other commanders, Joab, and he asked him to put Uriah in the hottest spot in the battlefield so that he might be killed and slain, finished, so that again the crime would be hidden. And of course it ended up, as you know, with the slaying of Uriah. Now, for the Muslim, he finds that this is totally unacceptable, and he believes, a Muslim believes, that this can never be an original or genuine revelation given to any prophet. Because a prophet who does this type of things definitely would be contradictory to the concept of prophet as explained in the Quran, and also contradictory to the very logic of prophethood as Islam presented. In fact, these were not the only incidents. Of course, there is the famous story about Prophet Abraham when he went to Egypt and he had his wife with him, and she was so beautiful, so he was afraid that Pharaoh might take her away or something or kill him. Mm-hmm. So he claimed that it was his sister and let her go even inside the house of the Pharaoh, who tried to approach her to have a relationship with her. There are similar things about Prophet Solomon getting married to pagan wives, and then his heart was inclined towards their gods. This whole description, like I said, is totally, for the Muslim, contradictory to the text of the Quran, as well as to the role and function and perception of who the Prophet is.
Now you're really whetting our appetite. So why don't we elaborate a little bit on in what sense is it contradictory to the Quran, for instance, and to the prophetic tradition?
Okay. In terms of the Quran, there is no single passage in the entire Quran, no single passage. Even though the Quran talks about all of these prophets, all of them are mentioned in the Quran, but there is no single passage in the Quran that attributes such cardinal sins that really blemish the moral character of the prophet, as we have seen cited in various places in the Old Testament. In fact, the contrary is true. All of these prophets are mentioned with a great deal of adoration and respect. About the prophets David and Solomon, they are mentioned as people who are returnees to God, people who are really faithful to God. About Prophet Jacob, not as a deceiver or cheater, but as a respected and holy messenger, prophet of God. I'll give you some examples. For example, on Prophet Abraham, he was described in the Quran as a man of truth. That's in 1941. He was also described as devoutly obedient to God and true in faith. In 16:120, Prophet Ishmael is described in 1954 as one who was strictly true to his promise.
And Ishmael was the son of Abraham.
It was the second son of Abraham. He has Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael is the grandfather of Prophet Muhammad, the grandfather, and Isaac, of course, was the grandfather of all the Israelite prophets.
Yeah, he was the first son.
Ishmael was the first.
Yeah, Ishmael was the first.
Exactly, Ishmael was the first time because, as you know, the wife of Abraham was barren.
Was barren,
And then later on, she got Isaac. This is an interesting area that we'll come to later, perhaps, in terms of the connection between the various monotheistic faiths. But of course, when God mentioned about Ishmael as being true to his promise, the biggest promise is to obey God and to be faithful to him. About Prophet Moses, he's described in the Quran as mukhlasan, translated roughly as one who was specially chosen. That's in 1951. About Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, he's giving a very tender description in the Quran as وَجِيهًا فِي الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ. It touches my heart when I recited, really. وَجِيهًا فِي الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ. In English it means that Jesus was one who is held in honor in this world and in the hereafter, and of the company of those nearest to God. The reference to that in the Quran is in chapter 3, verse 45. About Prophet Muhammad, he is described as a model. For example, we read in 33:21 that you have, O believers, indeed in the messenger of God, that is Muhammad, a beautiful pattern or model of conduct for any whose hope is in God and in the final day. And like I said, these are not the only citation. I could go on and on giving you more. But just to give you an example of generalization that are made about more than one prophet, about groups of prophets, we read, for example, in 21:90 that these prophets were quick in emulation in good works. They used to call on us, that's on God, with love, reverence, and humble themselves before us. That's in 21:90. So they always talk about reverence, respect, and praise of all of those great prophets. This is one aspect, the text of the Quran. I say also that these stories that were cited from the Bible are inconsistent with the Muslim view of the role and nature of prophets, the logic of prophethood. In what sense? Well, as we said before, a prophet is not somebody just who comes and communicates the words of God to people. He is a person to exemplify in his own behavior, in his own moral standard and actions, the message that he's preaching. He doesn't preach something and do something contrary. This is very essential. How could then a prophet be an example, a model for people, when he is a liar, cheater, drunkard, adulterer? You know, all these descriptions are descriptions of people who are really very wicked. How could a prophet be a model of faith in God when his heart is inclined towards other idols or other pagan deities? You know, this is something that's totally inconceivable in the mind.
Logical, really.
Yeah, it's a very logical point to make, really. That's why, like I said before, the Quran always indicates that the prophets were specially chosen. They have even more privilege over the pious.
Right.
In other words, if they were pious people who do not commit this major sin that blemishes their moral character, then definitely the prophet should be even above that. To give documentation on this issue, I'll give just three verses on the Quran. There are more. One, Allahu yastafi min al-malaikati rusulan wa min al-nas. God chooses messengers from angel and from people. That's in 22:75. Surely the choice of God is much better than what these stories depict. Also in 6:86 in the Quran we read, and to all, that is to all prophets, we gave favor above the nations. Also, and we made them leaders, guiding people by our command, and inspired them, notice this, and inspired them to do good deeds, to establish regular prayers, and to practice regular charity, and they constantly served us. That is in 21:73. So the inspiration was not just by message, knowledge, philosophy, dry philosophy. It was inspiration also by meaning and by actions in their own lives. And this is the essence of the Islamic concept of Isma, I-S-M-H, Isma, or the infallibility of all the messengers and prophets of God.
Now, some of the viewers may fall into a logical trap here, a sort of a seeming inconsistency. And that is, on the one hand, in the last episode we've been talking and we've overemphasized and we went at length to quote chapter and verse in the Quran proving the humanity of the prophets. And now we may get the impression that they are human, but they are infallible. How do you reconcile this? How do you dissipate that inconsistency, if such an inconsistency is there altogether?
In other words, you're asking as to whether infallibility is inconsistent with humanity.
With humanity, right.
Not really. If you make the distinction between errors or sins, if you want, then that would resolve the problem very easily.
Please when do, then.
Okay. Well, at least there are three kinds of sins, at least the way I can classify them to facilitate it. there are sins which relate to deviation and error in belief in God, like believing or inclination towards other gods, for example, gods, small g.
Yeah.
This is one type of error. A second type of error is what you might call a cardinal sin, something horrible, something really very bad, like I said, cheating, committing adultery with somebody else's wife and all this stuff. This is a very major, distinct group of sins. And then there is a type of sin which could be a human error in judgment, which does not constitute a violation of a basic moral law, Ten Commandments, for example, as the Jews and Christians understand it, nor does it really reflect any bad intention on the part of a prophet making this error or mistake.
Well, an error with malice aforethought, kind of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
With premeditated type of
violation.
But if we take that structures to facilitate our answer, then we can say, first of all, the old prophets and messengers of God are very infallible, absolutely infallible with respect to the first and second
dimensions, yeah.
Exactly. In the first dimension, they cannot be fallible as far as the communication of the message of God about faith. Because if the prophet makes an error in conveying the message of God, then he's not qualified. He's confusing. He's leading people astray. Instead of saying worship God, you say worship gods.
The whole structure crumbles. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's why, to quote just one verse from the Quran, again, the translation in English does not convey the origin or the beauty of the original, but I'll explain it. In 69, verses 44 through 47, it says, and if the messengers were to invent any saying in our revelation that's attributing
God's
this in God's revelation, if a messenger tried to change, we should certainly seize him by his right hand, and we should certainly cut off the artery of his heart, nor could any of you withhold him from our wrath. That's a symbolic meaning. What it really means is that no prophet can fall into an error of conveying the belief, the proper, pure belief as dictated or communicated to him by God, or else God would definitely stop him from making this falsification and leading people astray, if he's really a genuine messenger and prophet. This is one. The other second category of sins are sins that everybody agrees that, yes, we are humans, we have all this temptation. However, we know that there are certain sins that are really cardinal. To steal somebody else's wife and commit adultery and then cheat and try to do all kinds of tricks to avoid facing this kind of crime definitely is something that is not consistent.
Not a borderline crime.
Exactly.
You know,
not a borderline.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we know that many people who are reasonably pious who do not do these things as bad. How about the select better person who's supposed to be a prophet or messenger of God? But when you come to the third category of errors, errors in judgment and something very minor, and even with good intention, not really a deliberate type of mistake, this is not necessarily contradictory with the infallibility of the prophets. It's infallibility in a sense that it does not affect their basic function as prophets, source of revelation, and model also of human behavior.
It would be nice, actually, if you could give us an example of this third category of errors.
Well, there are so many examples. Maybe I can just pick one particular example. And surprising enough, it applies even to Prophet Muhammad himself.
Beautiful.
See, so that it shows, by the way, the reason I took that example is that there are still some people who are not familiar with the true facts about Islam who says, for example, or insinuate that, oh, Muhammad wrote the Quran, again, rejecting this notion of revelation. Mm-hmm. But if it's true that Muhammad wrote the Quran or invented it and lied and said that this came from God, which is, of course, absolutely untrue, then definitely he would not include in that Quran any verse or passage that rebukes him. How could someone write something
self-incrimination?
It can't be. But we find it in the Quran, which shows that there's another authority above Muhammad that gave him this instruction and revealed this information to him. This is a famous chapter, chapter 80 in the Quran, the title of which in English usually is He Frowned, in original Arabic, Abbas. And this chapter was revealed as a commentary and correction in a particular interesting story. And the story briefly is this. Prophet Muhammad in the early days of Islam was trying to invite the leaders of the noble tribe of Quraysh to Islam. He had very good reason to emphasize and focus on them. These were opinion leaders. And he thought that if he wins them to faith and they believe in God and reject idolatry, then this would encourage other people to follow suit. Furthermore, he also said or felt that those people are involved in persecuting Muslims because they are powerful. And if those people are one to faith and understand Islam properly, perhaps this would lead them to be more sympathetic and they stop that persecution.
Word of their evil. Yeah. Exactly.
So this was a human judgment which, before you know the rest of the story, you said, all right, what's wrong did the Prophet do? It's perfectly all right. He's doing that not for any personal gain, but rather for propagation of the message of truth. And while he was talking to them earnestly and in concentration, there came an old, poor, blind man by the name of Abdullah ibn Umm Maktoum. And that person has wanted to ask the Prophet to teach him something about the Quran. And he kept bugging him, asking him. The Prophet, again, in his human judgment, with all good intention, he showed a little bit of impatience and frowned a little bit. Because, in a way, he said, all right, this man is already a believer. Couldn't he wait a little bit until I really talk to those people who might be
more important business.
Exactly. Not business for him.
No, I understand, yeah.
Business
right.
In terms of attracting them to faith.
That's right, yeah.
And it's beneficial.
For the reasons we mentioned before, yeah.
Exactly. For the benefit of faith in general. So he showed a little bit of impatience. But then came to him Gabriel with this. I'll just recite a few verses from this chapter. It says, he, that is Muhammad, frowned and turned away because there came to him the blind man interrupting. But what could tell you that he, that is the blind man, might be purified, or that he might receive admonition and the teaching might profit him? As to one who regards himself as self-sufficient, the rich, the powerful, to him, O Muhammad, do you attend, though there is no blame to you if he is not purified. Very powerful rebuke of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, but still it doesn't accuse him of any moral sin or any mistake in belief, but simply even as judgment with all good intention, still God shows him that there is a wisdom higher than human wisdom, and that a poor, blind person who is sincerely a believer is better than this whole bunch of rich, powerful unbelievers who are so proud, so puffed up with pride that they are not listening to the message of the Prophet. Indeed, it's interesting to know that after this incident, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, used to hold that man, Abdullah, in great esteem. And whenever he met him, he said, أَهْلًا بِمَنْ عَاتَبَنِي فِيهِ رَبِّي, which means, welcome to he for whose sake God rebuked me. He used to give him that love and affection. And that's why many people misunderstand statements made in the Quran, either commanding great prophets like Abraham or Muhammad, or quoting them as saying they sought the forgiveness of Allah. لِيَغْفِرَ لَكَ اللَّهُ مَا تَقَدَّمَ مِنْ دَمِكَ, so that God can forgive you, O Muhammad, whatever you have done of errors. And they say, look, that's an evidence that those prophets are sinful. And this is a very erroneous and superficial way of looking at it. Because, number one, like I said, it's error, but it's only error in the sense of human judgment with good intention. And secondly, the point that is always forgotten is that a mistake for the Prophet is not like a mistake for a common man.
Of course.
See, a Prophet, because of the very high standard demanded of him in his morality and behavior, even the slightest mistake, even of judgment, is a serious one. Not because it's serious in itself, but because of the standard expected of him.
Right.
Not only this, a Prophet also because of his purity. No matter how worshipful and sincere he may be, he always feels he's not really doing worship as he should. He's not doing enough. So he always asks God for forgiveness.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jamal. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us. And we hope you'll join us in the following episode on Islamic Prophethood. Until then, this is Muhammad Hosni signing off. And may peace be upon you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.